or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to Information Week Radio for the week of March 14th, 2016. I'm your host, Executive Editor Dave Wagner, pinch hitting for Kurt Franklin. Kurt wanted to be here today, but unfortunately, Information Week was hit with ransomware, and we had to give Kurt away as the ransom. No, actually, Kurt is at an interview, but I like to come up with little fantasies like that. But speaking of ransomware, we've got a great panel today featuring our very own security expert. I like to think of her as our professor in defense against the dark arts. She is Sarah Peters, senior editor of Dark Reading. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you for having me, Dave.
Also joining us today is someone who could absolutely teach a class on the cloud or probably pretty much any other IT subject you could name. He's Information Week's own editor-at-large, Charlie Babcock. Welcome, Charlie.
Good to be here, Dave.
Thanks. Well, thanks, both of you. Charlie, if you don't mind, I'd like to start with you. There's a pretty big anniversary today. Amazon Web Services, I believe, turned 10, which is the aluminum anniversary, if I'm not mistaken. Can you tell us a little bit, give us a little background, where Amazon started 10 years ago, where it's come, how do you think Amazon has changed the public cloud in the last 10 years as well?
Well, gee, an awful lot has changed. Amazon sort of invented the cloud coming out with the S3 storage service 10 years ago, its first service. And in effect, it was an attempt to make a profit center out of some surplus infrastructure that it was operating for Amazon.com retail. But they also realized they had an opportunity to do something new and different, and they tend to think big up there in Seattle. And so they redesigned that infrastructure to be much more self-regulating, automated, end-user, able to provision themselves and be billed automatically through a kind of uniform system that could be operated in different data centers. They did such a good job of it that an awful lot of people have wanted to copy them since, including Microsoft, Google, and IBM. And so we have the public cloud with the newly designed infrastructure from Chris Pinkham and a team that came up with it in South Africa. And it's grown and grown. At the end of 2015, it had accounted for $7.9 billion in revenues at Amazon. That's not huge in terms of Amazon because Amazon retail pulled in about $99 billion. So it's not yet the tail wagging the dog. But on the other hand, it's much more profitable than retail. It's got operating margins of 25%. And it's growing much faster. I think it's growing at a 50% rate, has been for several years, and that's just a tremendous business to have if it's highly profitable. So it has changed the face of computing. It's given us public clouds on many fronts, and IT is kind of watching Amazon and watching it come up with new services, some of which fit nicely into kind of future IT operations. Amazon is developing a knack for that. And so its influence continues to grow and spread.
Right. And it's astonishing, 50% growth year over year with that kind of margin. So what's interesting, though, is that today in the news, I'm not sure if you got a chance to see this, they did lose a major customer, which is Apple. Apple, who has not yet fully built out its own public cloud the way Microsoft and Google, IBM, Amazon have. iCloud services still use other public cloud services, Azure and Amazon, and today it was announced that Apple had made a deal for some of that service to move to Google's cloud. Does that change the cloud landscape when we're talking about such big names and moving, or is that just some sort of normal sort of inside baseball stuff we don't need to think about?
Well, gee, that's a tremendous vote of confidence for Google, which was the place that Apple said it was going to. But at the same time, Apple said it was continuing to use Microsoft Azure and Amazon. Google has a little more flexible approach in its public cloud where you can design the kind of servers that you want. And I think Apple will probably find a way to take advantage of that and other Google features. And in some ways, Google is less of a direct competitor to Apple than some of the other providers that it's currently using. So it probably is hedging its bets. It wants to know the major suppliers. It wants to be able to use them. And Apple's growing so fast itself that it would probably not want to be building data centers helter-skelter around the globe. It'd like to use somebody else's.
So you don't think we'll ever see an Apple Cloud Services?
As a separate entity, maybe we will. I know of the two modern data centers they're building in Prineville, Oregon, and in Maiden, North Carolina. They're model data centers. Apple is pouring resources into them and insisting that they'll be operated by green power. But I don't think that they can power everything that Apple wants to do. And if Apple is going to keep selling iPhones and iTunes and everything else that it's got going, it better have some backup data center horsepower available to it.
Fair enough. So, Sarah, I want to get to you soon, but I want to ask Charlie one more question here. It would be remiss of us to talk about something that turned 10 years old without talking about the next 10 years. Obviously, you know, we can only ask you so much to look into your crystal ball. But where do you see Amazon Web Services going in the near future, in the couple of years, in 10 years? And what are some of the other companies, technologies that you're watching in the cloud space that might drastically alter the way Amazon is thinking or working?
Wow. I have trouble enough understanding the past 10 years and looking forward. The changes are going to the changes are going to come fast and furious. If anything, we'll learn to provide more dense computing in the cloud. And in a sense, that's all the cloud was, a new way to distribute compute cycles. And by pouring them out of the cloud through to many customers, you could pack the servers with a lot more work and get a much higher utilization rate out of every piece of equipment. That was part of the cloud economics. We'll continue that. We may move from virtual machines in the cloud to containers. And if we can do that, then we will get the same improvement in density that we got with virtualization, which was at least a 10x improvement in utilization. The average enterprise server was used 10 or 15% of its capacity, and virtualization came along and increased that to 60, 70, 80%. Containers could do that again, in which case our computing becomes much more efficient and much lower cost. But we're not there yet. I'm trying to watch, see what develops. Google is a cloud provider, but it does not serve its customers in containers, even though it's the containerization expert on the planet. They run their own internal affairs on containers. They run their search engine on containers, which is one of the reasons you get such fast search results. But as a cloud customer, your workload will be put in a virtual machine. Until we figure out a way to move that into containers safely, the issue is both security and isolation. We won't be able to achieve that density, but I see the cloud as trying to move in that direction. And we'll be seeking ever greater efficiencies and lower costs for customers. And more of enterprise IT will find it highly beneficial to move toward the cloud.
What's driving containers the most? Is it the IoT, or are there other reasons we're interested in it?
Oh, geez. There are many things driving containers. Number one, developers like to work with them. And by starting there and then following the path of a new application and keeping it containerized, you can speed everything up between initial development of source code right into testing, staging, and into production. And once in production, containers are a good mechanism through which to update software, to change it frequently, to provide the kind of continuous update idea. So the world, the enterprise in particular, wants to get to a container-oriented approach to IT operations. It's efficiency. It's better utilization of the compute resource. You can put many more containers on a server than virtual machines, primarily because each virtual machine has got its own operating system. A container doesn't need an operating system. It uses the host. And so we're looking for that efficiency. Companies that get it will have an advantage over other companies. You just don't see many challengers to Google search because it's such a efficient containerized operation.
Right. So I'd like to pause there for a moment because I think what we're about to talk about is going to cross right back into your expertise area. I'd like to turn to Sarah, who has patiently waited here for 10 minutes to scoop the crap out of us.
Charlie. I always learn
with our security.
Your turn, Sarah.
Yeah, so Sarah, Privacy Shield, something you wrote about today, is that just tinted windows for my limousine? Is that what I'm looking forward to? Or, you know, what do we need to know about Privacy Shield?
Okay. Let me back up for a second and tell you, Privacy Shield is the proposed replacement for Safe Harbor. Safe Harbor was a data transfer agreement between the European Union and the United States. So it allowed multinational organizations to store European citizens' personal data in the U.S. as long as you agreed to comply with the EU's data privacy laws, which are much more rigorous than what we've got over here. But in October, the European Court of Justice struck down Safe Harbor, which had existed for 15 years, basically on the grounds that U.S. surveillance laws are so sweeping, and U.S. privacy laws are so insufficient that there really is no way that we can protect privacy of Americans' data or Europeans' data, so there can be no safe harbor, and they just struck it down. So the technology industry and data protection authorities in the U.S. and the EU got together and patched together a new proposed agreement. That is EU-US Privacy Shield, and it is now undergoing a process of hopefully it will be approved. They're hoping that it will go into effect in June, but it's possible that it could be struck down by the European Court of Justice, just like Safe Harbor was, but we're just kind of waiting to see. In the meantime, there are still ways for people to, for companies to transfer data of European citizens. It's just clunkier. And the reason why everybody should worry about it is that other changes to EU law that are going to be going into effect soon hugely expand their definition of personal data. So while we think about things like social security numbers and maybe home addresses and stuff like that, they're expanding the definition to include things like genetic, mental, economic, cultural, social identity, things that could include your shoe size or your religion or all kinds of things that we never thought of as PII before, things that are a lot harder for you to just search for in, you know, with your basic technology. So now people that never thought that they had European citizens' personal data before are very soon going to realize, oh, no, I do have this data, and now I have a whole bunch of regulations that I have to comply with, privacy regulations, security regulations, and Privacy Shield is just the beginning of it.
Right. So if I'm Nike and I sold a size 10.5 running shoe to somebody in Ireland, I am, or I guess I should say France, because Ireland isn't in the EU. if I sold a 10.5 size running shoe to France, and even if I didn't keep the credit card information, I may now have to worry about what kind of information I'm holding?
When the EU General Data Protection Regulation goes into effect, yes. And that will be, now the General Data Protection Regulation is a different law. If you break that, you could have fines that are up to 4% of your annual revenue, which is pretty steep, your annual global revenue. You'll also have to report a data breach within 72 hours. And also, if you have customers in, you know, if you have that customer in France, then, and you want to process that data in your office in New York, then yes, you've got to make sure that you are complying with EU US Privacy Shield as well, and all of the other EU laws that apply to private data. So there's a patchwork of this stuff.
Right.
No, go ahead.
So obviously, I don't expect you to pull a number out of thin air, because that would be impossible. But do you see that this agreement is going to bring companies that never really thought of safe harbor into thinking about Privacy Shield? Are suddenly CIOs out there who were mainly U.S.-based suddenly going to have to think about something they never thought about before?
Absolutely, and it's several different things. The fact that the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, is the big thing, in my opinion, that it's not going to go into effect for a couple of years. But when it does, it's really going to be a problem because of that expansion of the definition of personal data. But in the short term, Privacy Shield, if it even is approved, and we don't know if it's going to be because it could get struck down. But even if it is approved, it also has new regulations in there as far as like data processors go. So if I have a bunch of customer data, or if I have data on say employees or third-party contractors who reside in the EU, and I am, say, outsourcing that to, a payroll, processor, something like that. There are now, or I am a payroll processor, there are a whole bunch of new rules now that I may have to comply with under Privacy Shield. And it's complicated. It's different than what you had to worry about before. And while only there were only 4,500 organizations that were certified under Safe Harbor before, and it was such a big deal then that there were a zillion headlines and meetings all over the place, and people flying back and forth between the European Union and the U.S. And mass panic in January when Safe Harbor was going to run out. Mass hysteria when Safe Harbor was going to expire. And there were only 4,500 companies that were directly involved with it. When this all goes down, it's going to be a much bigger issue, and I think a lot of people are not even aware of it.
Right. So if I'm a CIO and the mass hysteria has started and cats and dogs living together,
yes.
When all of that's going on, what can I do besides becoming an expert in reading this and trying to understand it? What are the kinds of skills I need to think about ramping up in my organization?
Okay, well, I think the very first thing is, well, I think the very first thing is to talk to your compliance officer, get your security, compliance, privacy, legal people together, and also your marketing people and your HR people and anybody who manages your website and does web forms, because this is going to affect all of you. The kinds of information that you regularly might be collecting from people for targeted marketing purposes, when they're registering for webcasts or when they're, you're just trying to get their clothes size because you're a retailer or whatever. That basic stuff might not be stuff you want to even bother collecting anymore if it's going to be more of a problem than it's worth. But whatever it is, it's going to affect all of you. The first thing is just to, sort of rally together and all become aware of the fact that this is going to be an issue. The next thing, and this is probably the biggest thing, is to work on your data classification. There's certainly technology out there that will help you in this regard, that makes it easy for you to search for data types, PHI and PII, things like social security numbers and credit card numbers and home addresses and that kind of thing. The technology can already find those things pretty easily. You can segregate Europeans' data from Americans' data pretty easily if you set it up like that from the beginning, so that you're not having to do all of that after the fact. But if you're right now already keeping a note of what data do I have, where is it, and how is it isolated and segregated, then once new rules go into effect, it's going to be much easier for you to encrypt what might need to be encrypted, destroy what might need to be destroyed, because there's also rules about the right to be forgotten that are going to be put into effect. So if a European citizen comes to your company and says, "I don't want to be on your database anymore," and you've got to destroy everything, they have a lot of rights, and they have a right for you to respond within a very limited time frame. So you have to know where that data is, all of the places that it is, and you've got to be able to destroy it within a limited time frame, or there are consequences. So classifying your data, up your data classification game right now, I would say that's what you need to do first.
Okay. Well, I think it's fascinating that the 20th century seemed about trying to be remembered, and the 21st century is about trying to be forgotten. Charlie, let's turn back to you. Charlie, you obviously work with the cloud. A lot of cloud companies, public cloud companies, need to work across borders. How do you think this new agreement, if it happens, is going to change the way cloud companies operate?
Well, it would change quite a bit. Right now, the major companies are scrambling to get data centers inside national geographies, inside nation boundaries. And you see Amazon trying hard to get into more spots in Europe, They started out in Dublin, Ireland. I believe they're in Frankfurt, Germany, and some other place in Germany. Plus, they plan to get into the London area. Right now, there are so many rules and laws saying you can't move the data over the national boundary that you have to do this as a cloud company. If you could just store it without worry about violating those rules and laws, then you could maybe create one data center that's well connected but bigger and hold your costs down. You might find more people able to get into the cloud business because you don't need quite so many spots around the world to be in compliance with rules and regulations. I don't know. It's still early. We've only got a few parties that could even claim to be serving the national data needs of companies in different countries at this point. Maybe that number will expand if we can enact this agreement.
Right. Is that a good thing? Do we want multinational cloud companies? Is that good for security, good for privacy, good for business? Or are we better off with more localized cloud companies?
Well, I think you could get different opinions on that. My own would be you will see better efficiencies, better operating efficiencies, lower cloud prices if someone can operate internationally. That might be a matter of opinion, and certainly I think in France, Germany, and some other places, they would kind of like their own cloud companies to thrive and prosper, and that's actually believed to be one of the reasons behind the barriers laws.
Yeah, what we can guarantee is that it's not good for the U.S. If you're thinking about it from an American perspective, this is not good for anybody trying to get more companies using American cloud services, because you're definitely saying it's a lot safer right now to have multiple data centers, multiple to segregate everything and set up. If you're going to have to err on the side of caution, keep everything over in the EU as opposed to having, if you had
That's
to err
right.
on the side of caution, you would just put everything in the EU and nothing over in the US, even if you were an American company. If you're an American company and you have European citizens in your database, you'd almost be better off just putting it all over in the EU as opposed to the other way around.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, even with Privacy Shield, and I'll ask either one of you this, or both of you really, even with Privacy Shield, does it make sense anymore to worry about keeping a data center here? I mean, these rules are going to change again, right? And it seems like the EU is taking the lead here when it comes to privacy and security over the U.S. Is it better... Not counting patriotism or flag waving, I don't care about that kind of thing. Is it better just to say, "Hey, let's go where the hardest rules are"? I remember listening to The Price is Right as a kid, and the car companies would always advertise that their cars were good for California emissions. Because California emissions were the hardest, right?
Yeah.
Right. So I eventually, it became 50 state emissions. Does it just make sense for, I don't know, Amazon, Azure, IBM, all these people, just float it all over in there and just get it over with?
Well, the business was invented here, not there. And the new ideas keep popping up within the organizations here or in startups and so on and so forth. To some extent, North America has to be a proving ground of cloud and has been. But even the Canadians will not allow their health data to be stored in the U.S. And you can't ask for two closer allies than the U.S. and Canada. So I don't want to see... Amazon data centers forced to migrate all European service to be delivered only from European data centers. I think that's a hardship and an unfair advantage, business advantage against Amazon. But, I don't know, Sarah, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I feel the same way that Charlie feels, the same way. At the same time, what this particular situation is with Privacy Shield, the reason that the thing was shot down was really to do with other American laws. It had to do with surveillance, and it had to do with a lack of privacy laws from the country in the first place. So it's kind of outside of the company, the individual company's hands. Even if you comply with EU data protection laws, just by virtue of being in the U.S., you can't really do what they want you to do. You can't really comply with them if the data is here at all, unless they can work out some kind of agreement, unless the agreement is approved. So we really don't know. And this agreement, even if it holds, it's going to be reviewed every single year. So if the U.S. passes new surveillance laws that are more invasive, then this thing could get struck down. It could get struck down next year, and it could be a moving target. So it, Dave, you know, to your point, a really, really, nervous business. Sure, maybe they would just want to say, forget it, let's not even bother, let's just set up shop over there, put all our data centers in the most rigorous place, and leave it at that, and not even bother. I don't know. I mean, there's an argument for it. There really is.
Right. Well, I'm sure we're going to be talking about this for months to come, because it's a really important topic. But we're running out of time. I'd like to ask each of you one real quick question, if you don't mind keeping your answer to a couple of sentences, so that we can end roughly on time. Sarah, do you see any movement within Congress in the United States to change laws in order to protect the business in response to the fact that the EU keeps bouncing these agreements? Could you imagine any change in surveillance law to help protect the U.S. cloud industry or U.S. industry in general?
I have asked about that. I've asked people about that, and they say that they believe the pressures are strong enough that it can drive change. The House Judiciary Committee last month is now in seems to be kind of pushing against law enforcement in order to get some movement in that direction. I believe it's possible. I don't think it's going to happen very quickly.
Fair enough. And Charlie, one more question for you. excuse me. Let's say the balance of the cloud or other data services do push towards Europe in some way in response to this. Are there any infrastructure issues there, for instance, just the pipes going across Europe to the U.S. or anything like that? Do you see any infrastructure reasons why this is going to be a challenge, even if it happened that way?
I think the infrastructure would be there if there were the demand for it. The infrastructure has not been the holdup, and so I think we should assume if it's needed, it'll get built.
Okay, fair enough. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, guys. But before we go, first of all, I'd like to thank both of you for a fantastic conversation. Second, I'd like to find out what's coming up in the week ahead for both of you. Sarah, I know your job is very news-driven, but can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on and where we can find you on social media to find out about that?
Sure. I'm working on a piece about the Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act. Finally, some guidelines came out from Department of Homeland Security about how you can do your information sharing and stay get your liability protection. So there'll be a bit of a how-to coming from me next week. And you can find me on Twitter at Sarah Peters, no H in Sarah. That's the best way to find me.
Great. And Charlie, what are you working on for the week ahead, and how can we find you on social media?
Well, it's time for Information Week to revisit the NTP protocol and update what's going on with Harlan Sten's work on the protocol and his team of open source developers. Also, the dilemmas they face as they need to move part of their infrastructure and they need to pay attention to security issues that have been researched and aired to them in various ways. They have their hands full. And also, I'll be taking a quick look at new container security measures coming out of CoreOS. We need to be able to scan and check that all elements of the container have had their suitable patches and updates to keep them protected.
Great. Well, I'm looking forward to all of that from both of you. As for me, I'll shortly have a story out about where the IT jobs are in the United States, the five fastest growing IT communities and the five that are struggling the most. And some of those answers will surprise you just a little bit. You can find me at Geek and Dave on Twitter and Information Week and allanalytics.com. For my guests, Sarah Peters, Charlie Babcock, for our host in absentia, Kurt Franklin, this is Dave Wagner thanking you for showing up at Information Week Live. We'll see you next week. Thanks a lot.